This is Calliope Writing Coach, the podcast about writing and publishing success from every angle. I'm Angie Fenimore, international best-selling author and writing coach.
And I'm Michael Sheen, author, platform designer, and marketing master. Episode 19, The Million Dollar Mentor. Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach podcast. Michael and Angie in the house.
Hello.
Okay, so I totally apologize for the audio quality of this interview. We did this interview kind of before I knew what I was doing. So sorry about that. And we'll get it right in the future.
And today we have a very special guest, Mr. David Farland. Welcome, Dave.
Yay.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do. Yeah, Dave is one of my mentors.
There you go.
My favorite people.
So David Farland is a New York Times bestselling author who has penned over 50 science fiction and fantasy novels for adults, young adults, and children.
Yeah, you heard that right.
Along the way, he has also worked as a creative writing instructor, a video game designer, and as a screenwriter. He has won numerous awards for his fiction, including the Philip K. Dick Memorial Special Film Award in Science Fiction, the Whitney Award for Best Novel of the Year in Historical Fiction, the International Book Award for Best Young Adult Novel of the Year, and the Hollywood Book Festival's Book of the Year Award, among others. In 1999, Dave set the Guinness record for the world's largest book signing. He's taught creative writing at Brea.
You'll have fun editing.
Dave has taught creative writing at Brigham Young University, at private workshops, and in conjunction with his work at Writers of the Future. Over the years, many of his students have gone on to publish with tremendous success, including New York Times bestsellers like Stephanie Meyer of the Twilight fame, Brandon Sanderson, who wrote the Wheel of Time series, and James Dashner, who is famous for The Maze Runner. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, good to be here.
This is so great to have you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast with us. We've really enjoyed our association with you. And I'm always amazed when you show up at one of our conferences and just, you know, share your wisdom and wealth of knowledge and experience. So thank you so much.
I'm scribbling notes about as fast as I can, and my knees are knocking because I'm just, it's like, you know, Brad Pitt, he's got nothing on you.
Well, he's got the looks. Okay. That's the one area I got short of him.
Hey, yeah, you know, I think we all lack in that area when it comes to Brad, but so what have you been up to, Dave?
You know, I've been just teaching writers. I've been doing a lot of editing. The Writers of the Future contest is probably one of the top two or three largest contests in the world. And it keeps getting bigger every quarter. So every quarter we're setting new records for the number of entries. So that takes a lot of time. Wow. And then I do, I'm working on my writing. I'm trying to finish up my last Rune Lords novel number 9. I've got a bunch of other projects in the works that I'm excited about. So I've got an awful lot to do, but I just feel like I feel overwhelmed.
Yeah, that is a lot going on for sure. Tell us a little bit more about the Writers of the Future.
Okay, well, L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future has been going for 33 years. I was the grand prize winner in 30 years ago, and I became the coordinating judge for the contest in 1992, and ran it till about 2000, at which point I went off to Hollywood to do some work there for a couple of years. But I've been running it again. I've been the lead judge now for the last 5 or 6 years, I guess. And so it's a huge science fiction, fantasy, horror writing contest, anything in the genres for short stories. It's for new authors. We publish 12 prize winners per year for second, third placers from each quarter. And then we have a big grand prize contest for the best story of the year. We pay $5,000 for that story for the award for that, in addition to the quarterly prizes, and we bring all of the writers in for a writing workshop. So every year, and last week of March, first week of April, I go to Hollywood, teach a writing workshop for about a week to the people that we bring in from all over the world. We have winners this year from the UK, one from Nigeria, or Australia, Canada, the US. I think we had one last year from Finland. So, you know, we get a good variety of people. Talented writers all, you know, they really are have to be the best of the best in order to win the contest. And so...
Well, we'll make sure and get that in the show notes so that people know where to find that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And how many submissions do you get?
You know, I'm not allowed to talk about that. Let's just say that I get thousands and thousands of them, we'll put it that way.
Wow.
So yeah, it really is quite an honor.
We're afraid that, you know, people knew how many people you were competing against, but, you know, you're really only competing against yourself and you just write the best you can do and see if we can pull it off.
Excellent.
Yeah. And what great experience though, too, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of fun because, you know, you get to watch these people start out as new authors. Many of them, this is their very first publication of any kind. And we see them, you know, take off and become prize winners. Hugo Nebula Award winners. Our people have won. We had one that won an Oscar a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow. Well.
So that was nice.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. I would think that would be an incredible way to launch a career is to submit and win that contest. That's what you did.
Yeah, yeah. I started out as a prize writer. You know, I was in college and I wrote a story and my teacher suggested that I turn it into a contest and I won third place and, you know, it was $50 and I thought, wow, I spent 7 hours writing that story. You know, if I'd spent a couple more, maybe I would have won first place. So I set a goal to win first place in a writing contest for the following year. And I wrote the story and then I thought, well, gosh, I'm to write another one and another one and another one. So I wrote half a dozen stories and was hoping to win first place in a contest. And I ended up winning first place in all of the contests that I entered that year. So, it just kind of exploded. That really helped launch my career.
Yeah, I would suspect that would be a great way.
Yeah.
And something, you know, something that we really just love about the writing community is, you know, when somebody does have success, you know, there's a lot of mentoring that goes on, but you have really been the success or, you know, like mentored or the wings beneath, you know, for a lot of writers that have.
Yeah. I don't know how many authors I've helped, you know, get their first publication. Years ago I used to keep track and I would critique stories and writers of the future. I'd say, fix this, fix that, send it to this editor. And people would write me back and say, yeah, I did that. And it worked, you know, it worked about 300 times, you know, by about 1993. And then I quit counting. So at this point it's been hundreds and I've got, you know, a lot of authors I've trained probably, close to 100 people who are New York Times bestsellers.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, a good handful of them that are number one New York Times bestsellers. So so I've really enjoyed doing that. And I think that just because I have trained so many writers who've gone on to become New York Times bestsellers, it seems like if people are really serious about writing, they seek me out. So, you know, it just works out pretty well.
That's great. So I want to actually hear about this record, this Guinness.
Oh,
yeah, your book signing mm-hmm. record.
Yeah, well, you know, I gave at least three or four book signings where nobody ever showed up. You know, so I learned how to do it wrong, and then eventually we started figuring out how to do it right. But I actually launched a little book in about 1999 called. It was based on a screenplay that L. Ron Hubbard wrote called A Very Strange Trip. And it was just a comic science fiction piece. And I was kind of drawn to it because the story is about a guy from West Virginia who's a moonshiner who ends up marrying a Cherokee Indian woman. and he travels. He's got this truck, and every time that he's in the truck and it bounces, there's a time machine in the back, and it sets off the time machine, and he goes into a different time period. And so as a kid, I was always interested in dinosaurs. My grandfather was from West Virginia. He was a moonshiner, and he was married to a Cherokee Indian. So I'm a quarter Cherokee to boot.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But it was just fun to put all of that into a story and see if I could try to capture the accent. I remember the very first time I ever called one of my grandfather's brothers. I called my Uncle Clyde Wolverton back in West Virginia, and he answers the phone and he says, "Hello?" And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I think I got the wrong number." And I hung up. And then I thought, wait a minute, he lives in West Virginia. His name is Clyde. He probably does talk like a hillbilly. So I called him back up and I said, "Hello, is this Claude Wolverton?" And he says, "You must be one of Jackie's boys." He says, "I told Nora," I said, "Nora, I think that's one of Jackie's boys, because they's the only Yankees we know." And I just fell in love with that accent. Oh, and I've got to try to do that in the book sometime.
So how did you get so many people to attend the book signing?
Well, there's a book actually you can buy too, by the way, which I own.
$1 million book signings. Yeah. Yes, we are definitely familiar with that.
Yeah, and I just want to say that, you know, I love your series, $1 million book signings, $1 million outlines. Yeah, I have several of them. And I actually use in the company of angels as an example, like how to deliver a hook. Like I use that as well. But anyway, we'd love to hear about this. How did you do this?
A lot of it is pre-publicity. You know, you go to the bookstores and you usually have what's called an anchor bookstore that is a big bookstore in the area. Like you go to a Barnes & Noble and you're in the Los Angeles area, then they'll say, okay, this is our anchor store. And what you do is you put up a book signing, but we'll put out word out to 9 other bookstores in the area. And that way you can draw in people from 100 miles away to your book signing. So you get some publicity, and part of it is through newspapers. In this particular case, we had a live radio talk show going on, and we brought in some bands and we brought in some movie stars and we had the books, and everybody knew that we were up to try to win the Guinness record for the world's biggest book signing. And we had free root beer floats and things like that. And we just made it into a big party. And I think that's the key, is when you do a book signing, you don't go get a little table and go just sit in the back of the bookstore and hope people will come up and talk to you. What you do is you go to the bookstore and you do a reading and you get people excited about your book, because there's going to be a lot of people in the store who don't know who you are. But once they hear you reading, they're going to go, "Oh, wait, there's a real author over there." And so you talk about things that interest you and that will interest them. And you know, you take some treats and you try to pull people in. So for example, when I did my little book of Mice and Magic, I took of Mice and Magic and I went to elementary school, and you talk to 1,000 kids at an elementary school. And you do that 3 times a day. And then you have a big book signing near the elementary schools at night, okay? So the kids can come. And so when I did that, my very first time, you know, we brought in probably 500 kids along with their parents. So they were lined up for a mile and a half down the street to buy the books. But that's part of prepping the waters, you know, making sure that you can draw in as much of an audience as you can. But it doesn't always work that well, you know, obviously. You know, typically I would think that if you were to talk to 1,000 kids, you know, you would have maybe 100 books that you would sign or something like that.
Yeah.
But in an affluent area or something, it can work really well. And if you get a really great performance when you're talking about your book and things like that, kids will decide that they love it and they'll latch on, you know.
Well, something I hear too, like in the background, is that you've turned it around so it's not about you. Like they're participating.
Yeah.
You know, like they get to participate in this you know, new record.
Yeah, this event. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important. Yeah.
How many books did you sign that particular day?
Well, on that day, I signed 2,300 while the judges were there for the Guinness Book of World Records. I signed probably another 5,000 on top of that.
Wow.
When the judges weren't there, because the judges just got tired and went home because, you know, they're sissies. No, they were good about that. But you have to have judges there to make sure that it's an individual person who comes through and, you know, they're not buying the books in bulk. They're buying them for themselves, right, et cetera, et cetera. So if I have somebody who comes through and wants five books, but he's just one buyer, you get to count one book, you know.
Okay.
So you just have to do them as fast as you possibly can. It's pretty
busy. I imagine
busy
your
work.
Signature doesn't look the same after that.
No, I think it was probably pretty bad. You know,
I imagine if your hand doesn't work the same afterwards either.
You know, it's really funny because I took some ibuprofen before I did it because I thought, okay, this is going to be painful. And I was actually able to get through it all pretty well. But about a week later, this is my signing hand, my finger shot out like this, and I couldn't bend my finger back in. It just got this cramp. And so I was walking around pointing at things all day. But, you know, I feel lucky because, you know, sometimes these guys that win Guinness World Records, you know, like the guy who catches a cannonball with his gut, you know, from the farthest cannon shot, you know, a mile and a half away. I don't have to worry about getting hurt or anything like that.
Yeah,
this kind of thing.
Jumping the Grand Canyon or anything like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. This is pretty tame stuff.
Yeah.
So do you still hold the record?
No, I lost the record in 2007 to a chess master in Mexico City who wrote a book on how to play chess, and so he beat me out. Yeah, so I'm going to have to go take that record back. Yeah.
You'll have to let us know when that's happening, too.
Yeah,
I don't know. We'll have to see.
So I guess that kind of leads me to my next question is, I mean, you've been in publishing now for how many years? 30 years?
Oh, 30 years, yeah.
30 years?
Mm-hmm.
How has the change in the publishing industry affected you? Have you seen a significant change as everyone else has?
Yeah. It was easier in the old days, you know, where you had your publisher and they would go out and work on the promotion and things like that. In today's world, I think most successful authors spend a lot more time working on pre-publicity. They do their blogs and their Facebook pages and their Twitter accounts and whatever else it is that they do. There's a lot more hands-on and a lot more talking to the public. I think that that's good in some ways because it really helps you measure the public's reaction to a project. You know, while you're in the process of writing it, you can send out sample chapters to your fans and get their feedback. And I think that that's really great, but it can be very time-consuming. And that's the biggest problem. There is a lot of money to be made in the self-publishing industry now.
I want your take on that
because I still feel like, you know, traditional is the way to go just because you're a publishing thing. And then you have this thing out there that you wish you could pull back and, you know.
Yeah, I think I think that it depends really entirely on the kind of book that you write. I have several authors that I've trained who are romance authors, you know, who are making a couple hundred thousand a year. And they're making a lot more money as romance authors being self-published than they would make if they were published by traditional publishers.
Oh, interesting.
And so in that particular field, I think you can do great. I think it's a lot harder to do that with thrillers, science fiction and stuff like that. We seem to have a couple of big authors who can make a living being self-published in each of the other fields, but romance is really the one.
So we're talking about romance, not erotica, right?
There's a lot of people that, I don't know, they blur the line. I don't know. because there are some who are making pretty good money in erotica. I think that the erotica field, to me, it just seems like there's so much competition. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, there's a lot of women who love fairly steamy romances, and you just have to figure out, you know, where do you fit on the line as far as, you know, your moral principles and mm-hmm. what you want to do with your fiction and stuff like that.
Wasn't it you that told us that when we were talking about ebooks, that who is reading ebooks? It's, you know, guys and businesswomen reading these books, you know, like
Gary Vaynerchuk.
Gary Vaynerchuk, and it's women who are reading like 50 Shades of Grey, but they don't want anybody to know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the thing about romances is the gaudy covers and things like that. If you were traveling business class, you wouldn't want to be reading something like that. Right. But when you've got an ebook, you don't have a cover on it. It's just your ebook folder. And so most of the women who are writing in the romance field are making a living at it or doing it off of ebooks. They seem to sell actually much better than paperbacks.
Yeah.
Not like I'm asking for myself or anything.
No. But you know, really it's a fascinating field because it's been changing and developing so quickly. And there are ways to make it in the field, but there's so much work to do that if you're doing your own covers and you're doing your own promotion and you're doing your own blogging and things like that, you know, then you can spend a lot of time trying to promote your book and to the detriment of your career. And that's the biggest problem that people have, is they just don't have the energy to do all that. Mm-hmm. The women that I know who are making a lot of money in it belong to what's called a writer's ring. And with the writer's ring, what you do is you get half a dozen people who are big authors in romance. And when you've got a book coming out, you promote your book. And if you don't have a book coming out, you promote their book. So you get half a dozen people who write similar kinds of things, and you cross-pollinate your readers, basically.
Yeah.
And that can be very, very lucrative. I know, I was talking to Mike Resnick. He's a Hugo and Nebula Award winning science fiction writer. And he was saying last year that he has a girl in his writing group who's making about $200,000 a month. And she feels bad because she's the smallest writer in her writing group.
Wow.
Her writer's ring.
Maybe we are thinking about a career.
I know, right?
So, yeah.
So still no romance on the horizon for you, though?
Well, you know... I don't think so. You know, I've tried a lot of different things, and romance has never been one that I felt like I could do anything with. I do put romance in every novel that I write. I think that if you're writing a story and you've got boys and you've got girls, I'm the kind who gets attracted to them. So, you know, I'm attracted to the women. So I feel like, okay, it just feels natural to me to have the romance angle in there. And so I actually really love romance to a certain degree, but I'm more of the date movie kind of romances. You know, if you look at something like Romancing the Stone or in my Courtship of Princess Leia, Star Wars novel, for example, mm-hmm. I mix it with plenty of adventure, I guess is what I do.
I'm not the romantic at all in this.
Yeah.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm the romantic in our relationship.
Honey, give me a drill. Cordless things.
Yeah. I'm really excited about what I'm doing. I've been studying neuro-linguistic programming and hypnosis and trying to figure out how to integrate that with my writing. Now, Edgar Allan Poe, back in the 1820s and 1830s, was the first writer to try to figure out how to use hypnosis in writing. And he did a lot of things with rhythms and with his choices of imagery that he used that really worked well, you know, towards creating a hypnotic effect. I, on the other hand, am coming at it at a time where we've learned an awful lot more about neuro-linguistic programming and hypnosis. And so I'm trying to figure out how to integrate that. So I've been teaching I've been developing a new class called Writing and Chatting Prose, in which I teach you how to hypnotize your reader. You know, you've picked up books where sometimes the book just carries you away and you forget that you're reading and you lose track of time. And you're just sitting there going through it. And all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, I've been sitting here reading for 16 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. And you have to absolutely go get a drink and take a potty break or something.
Right. Well, that's our intention as writers, is to be able to pull that off, you know.
And so what I've been doing is I've been studying very carefully how that is done. And, you know, I've been doing it for years with my books and doing it accidentally, I guess, is the best way to say it. Mm-hmm. Trying to make a book that enchants you, that carries you away, that makes you forget that you're reading. And I've been able to do that over and over, but now I feel like I'm coming at it with so much more understanding than I did before. You know, for example, one of the things that looking at a story that has that ability to charm a reader, okay, as we call it in NLP, is that we look at the pattern of what they speak about. People have different ways of looking at the world and trying to take in information. And so some people are primarily visual. 60% of the people, when they are gathering information, they look more at your body language. And so if you write a story and you've got great audio details, a tremendous voice, for example, the readers will actually become dissatisfied with it because we're not appealing to the senses that are their primary way of looking at the world. Okay. And then there's another 20% are audio. And so we're paying, I'm an audio person, you know, and so I pay very close attention to what you say and to your intonations and catch a lot of sounds in the backgrounds and things like that. And then there's another 17% who are primarily kinesthetic. And that means that they are into body motion. They learn primarily by touching and feeling and grasping and but they also are very often very closely attuned to emotions, emotional states. So if you write a story where a character kind of sees things and hears things, but you know, is doing a camera recording, but has no emotional states, you know, then readers feel lost. They feel like there's, you know, is this a robot I'm reading about, you know, or a real person? Mm-hmm. And so in order to charm a readership, you have to make sure that you get the right kind of information in the proper order so that the reader is swept away. And there's just really turning out to be, there's a science to it, but there's also an art to it. You know, I think art is
science too, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is...
It's just another form of science, but...
That's right, yeah. Basically, usually arts are sciences that we don't understand yet, I think is about the best way.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, there's a lot to be learned. So anyway, I'm real excited about that particular class right now.
And, so is this a class that you'll lead live? How are you delivering this content?
Right now, I'm just teaching it live. I've been practicing. I taught one in Phoenix recently, and I did one in Sydney, Australia, a couple of months ago. And I'm doing one coming up in Dallas, Texas, in a couple of months, in September.
Well, you'll have to let me know when you do it. You know, nearer to where I am, because I'd love to do that. Like, my experience of hypnotism is my dad and my uncle back in the 70s. We lived in Vegas, and my dad, like, considered himself an armchair hypnotist, and they put on this show. I remember one time my dad having my uncle standing on the coffee table, the whole family around just laughing. I'm in the cockpit of an airplane, and the pilot has had an accident, so my uncle has to land the airplane, and then he has to jump from the airplane, and my uncle took, no kidding, did a belly flop in the living room floor, cracked some ribs. But I get that experience of writing in that, or you know, getting information to write about in that space between awake and asleep. That's where all my good ideas come from.
It's an interesting thing because, you know, my instructor says that, you know, you can't really hypnotize somebody unless you enter a trance-like state yourself. You know, you kind of have to be there to take somebody else. And writing is very much like that. When you sit down to write, one of the first things that I work on is getting myself in the trance-like state so that I can write. You know, it's something that we do subconsciously. And many writers write in the in a hypnotic pattern anyway, just by nature. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a fun thing to be studying. So I'm working on that. And then years ago when I started teaching, I was going to write a book called Storytelling is a Fine Art. The basic idea is that form stories back in the 1920s and 30s, people started, you know, talking about genre literature and poo-pooing it and saying that it wasn't real literature because these were all formulaic stories. Well, having a formulaic story and having a form story aren't quite the same thing.
Exactly. Right. Completely different.
Yeah. You can have a beginning and a middle and an end, and you can have a powerful climax and a denouement, and it doesn't need to necessarily feel cheap and trashy and like you've done it 50 times before.
Well, I'm telling you, nobody recognized Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer when they were watching Napoleon Dynamite.
That's right.
Nobody went there. And yeah. It's identical. It's the story. It's the same story.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we do things like this all the time. You know, Robert Frost was living at a time when in poetry they were trying to reject formed poetry. And he had his famous quote where he said, you know, in rejecting that argument, he said, writing poetry without rhyme is like trying to play tennis without a net. You know, it loses something. And the same is true with writing formed stories. You can write beautiful prose and just awe audiences with that prose. But if you don't have a good story to go behind it or go with it, it becomes boring eventually. You know, there's very few really talented stylists who make any money in this business, you know, because it takes so long to write the prose. And when it does come out, you sell 2,000 copies or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't do much. So what I've been trying to do for years now is to figure out, how do you marry a formed story, write a formed story beautifully, and marry it to beautiful prose, you know, so that there's really nothing to criticize about the story, but to just sit back and be swept away by it. That's all I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Wow.
Excellent. So yeah, definitely. Where's the best place that we can find out about these courses as they
come? Oh, yeah.
I'll post it on your website.
Yeah.
My Story Doctor.
It's at mystorydoctor.com. Yep. Okay. And I'm going to be teaching a class in storytelling as a fine art for a week in Missoula, Montana, later on this year. And okay. I'm going to be teaching a writing and chatting prose. And I'll really be doing pretty much probably another writing and chatting prose kind of course down here in St. George too.
Okay.
Later in the year. But yeah, I'm trying to slow down a little bit this year. I want to take more time to finish some novels. So I'm not doing a lot of classes, but I am.
I hear that.
Yeah. But I'm doing quite a bit of teaching still.
You know, I know the thousands of throngs of your Rune Lord series would certainly like the completion of that series.
Yes. And, you know, I started writing that. I'm going to talk about something I don't talk about. I've never talked about this before. But, you know, I got writer's block with that book.
And oh, did you really?
I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I really wanted to do it well. I wanted to do it right. And my editor was pushing me to get it done now. And really pissed me off, you know.
Yeah, that's just like, that's not very helpful, is it?
And it was so bad that every time that I would try to write about it, I'd get enraged. And
it's like telling your kids to go clean their room.
Yeah, it really is. And it's stupid because I know that, you know, emotionally, logically, I realize he was just trying to do me a favor by saying, get that book done. But at the time that he did it, my mother was dying of cancer. And I was literally, took a phone call with one hand and was talking to him and was holding my mother's hand as she was dying, not with the other. And just the fact that he had the nerve to do that under those circumstances just made me say, screw you.
Yeah.
I don't want to ever do, I'm not going to work with you or for you again. Now that he's passed away, I feel like I can get back with the project maybe, but But it was funny how this block starts subconsciously because I wasn't Well, I was literally trying to get the book done, but it just seemed like every time I'd start doing it, I would feel like, no, I can't work on this book. I'm going to go work on something else. So, you know, I wrote In the Company of Angels and Nightingale and, you know, won a bunch of awards and did okay, but I did get away from the room lords for a bit. And fantasy is my first love. I find it odd that I would choose to get writer's block with a fantasy novel, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. That's because of how our brains work.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. All the faulty circuitry going on up there.
It got all wired up close to your heart, you know.
Yeah. I think that's it. I think it was almost too close to the heart is what's going on. As a writer, 20 years ago, if you'd asked me if there was such a thing as writer's block, I would say, that's just an excuse for lazy people. but the truth is that you can get blocked on a project. And I got blocked on the Rune Lords and was writing other books just fine. You know, it was just very odd to me. That there is such a thing as writer's block.
Yeah, and you know, to overcome that, it's all about actually rewiring your brain around it.
It is. You know? It is. And you know, the thing is that people say, "Oh, but there's no such thing as plumber's block or lawyer's block." I've talked to lots of lawyers who just said, "You know, I'm done. As of today, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life, but I'm done being a lawyer." You know, for example, and they'll leave the field. I think it happens in every field. I think in every field you get to a point where, you know, you just say, okay, I'm done with this. I'm going to go do something else. I'm going to go chase some other dream. And that's okay. But writing is a great field because I feel like with writing, we can do whatever we want in writing. I can write any kind of story I want for any audience that I want. I can change genres, change my name, be different people, you know, all kinds of things like that. And so it's a fascinating field for me, even after 30 years of doing it. Whereas every other job I've ever had, I got bored of really quickly.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the subject of genre hopping, you started out as a fiction writer, a science fiction writer, correct?
Yeah, I started out writing actually literary fiction and mainstream fiction when I was writing for contests. And probably my first big break was winning the L. Ron Hubbard Writers of the Future, winning the International Gold Award. That got me a 3-novel contract with Bantam Books. And so I was doing science fiction with Bantam Books. And I did that for about 10 years. And then for my 10th year anniversary, I decided that I wanted to write a fantasy novel finally. Mm-hmm. And so I decided as a birthday present to write The Rune Lords for myself. And I turned it into Tor. And after that, I was a fantasy writer and they didn't want any science fiction from me anymore. Mm-hmm. But I've also written, you know, like In the Company of Angels is a historical fiction with Nightingale. I wrote more of a teen thriller kind of a thing. So I can really do just about anything I want. I'm working on a novel now called The Blockbuster. It's about a young filmmaker working in China, making his first big fantasy film in China for the Chinese mob. So having fun with that, you know. So I really like to hop genres.
Do you find that your audience comes with you, that your readers of one genre hop over, or do you have to develop a brand new audience?
Different audiences. Some follow, you know, but a lot don't. I've gotten a lot of fan letters from people who said, you know, I used to love this writer named Dave Wolverton, you know, in science fiction. And then he kind of disappeared and I was kind of looking for new writers and I found this fantasy series called The Rune Lords and I thought, wow, this is the best thing I've seen since Dave Wolverton quit writing. And now
it's great. And now
I find out you're the same person. So when you see David Kahn writing thrillers, that'll be me. I think most likely. I'm going to keep the same first name. So when people say, "Hey, Dave," I'll know who they're talking to.
Yeah, there you go.
That's great. Yeah, that's smart.
But that's about it.
Yeah.
Either that or dad.
A dad, or old man, or something like that. Yeah. But yeah, I just enjoy writing, and I'd like to do, you know, I'd like to not be bound by genre at all, because, you know, you get new ideas for stories and they take you in directions that you didn't anticipate. And so I just like to have fun with it.
So I think the last time that we chatted, you were working overseas with a company to maybe turn your one of your series into a film. How did anything come of that?
You know, I got really close to turning the Rune Lords into a movie with Warner Brothers years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I've had some interest from a company in China. I got some producers who are talking to some major directors and film funders and stuff like that. But right now, not much is happening there. You know?
Okay.
That's the film industry.
That's the film industry. Yeah, they try to convince you that a lot's going on, but there's nothing going on. Yeah.
And I remember seeing something about, you know, The Princess Bride being kicked around as a script for 10 years before it was finally made. And then, you know, and it really wasn't thought of to be a big deal. And it kind of became this underground cult hit.
Yeah, the average movie in Hollywood takes 14 years to make from a book. So if you've got a book, the chances are that it'll take 14 years to make it.
Oh, good. It's not too late.
So when you get something like Harry Potter that gets made, you know, 2 years after the movie or the book came out, that's really rare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of the reason why is that film producers feel that for a book to be turned into a movie, they need an audience of 6 million people. And for readers, that's an awful lot of readers.
It sure is. Yeah.
And so if you start a good series, it's going to take you, you know, 5 or 8 or 10 years to reach that critical mass where the filmmakers see it as a viable IP.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it takes so long. And then, of course, when you do have a viable IP, you've got something like A Tale of Two Cities. Nobody looks at it and says, oh, this is so contemporary. It'll be a great blockbuster movie. You know, it only took 150 years for it to get a readership of 75 million.
Yeah. And maybe just to define a little bit of the code, IP is intellectual property.
Intellectual property, that's correct. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't think like normal
people anymore. Okay.
I'm the novice of the group, so I kind of hear that stuff and go, now wait, what was that again?
I remember.
So
yeah.
Code.
You spent quite a bit of time in Hollywood as a script greenwriter, isn't that right?
Yeah, I worked for a little company in Hollywood, not for a long time, just for a couple of years.
Okay.
But after I had, when I was writing Star Wars novels for Scholastic, the editor there really liked my stuff and asked me to help push big for the coming year. And so I looked over all the books that they had and chose Harry Potter to push big. And once that went enormous, and then Stephanie Meyer is one of my students at BYU, and she asked how to write the best-selling young adult novel of all time. So we outlined Twilight, basically did a little brainstorming session for that. And after that kind of gave me some credibility in picking winners, writers of the future. So I got a job working in Hollywood and really looking at their method for deciding what's going to be a big hit.
And they really have it down to a science.
And yeah, they have it more of a science, whereas with books, it was really kind of nebulous, you know. I had to make up my own rules, whereas with this, I learned a whole new science for writing or for greenlighting movies. What it comes down to is we look at a movie, we look at a screenplay, we look at the primary emotions that the screenplay evokes, and we give it a score based upon how well it does in the screenplay. As I read as a screenplay, I look for the different emotional beats in the story. And then we can give it a score based upon how well it compares to other movies and how it would have done well in the past. And we can actually figure out within about 2% of the audience, how many people will come to see that movie over the course of the first couple of weeks when it comes into the screen. And then once we do that, it's pretty easy to figure out, okay, how much money is it going to take to make this film? And if we can make twice as much money from screening a movie as we can make by you know, by as money spent, you know, then it becomes worth doing, because the movie theaters get 50% of the profit, basically. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I basically learned that. It's a big mathematical equation. It's not a hard one to learn, but there's a lot of nuances to it, because when we start looking at how big your audience is going to be, we have to look at different audience sizes around the country and go county by county in the United States and country by country around the rest of the world. And that can be quite complex.
Yeah, wow. Very different, I would think, from judging the Writers of the Future contest.
Yeah, it is, but it's a lot of the same skills, you know. When I look at a story in Writers of the Future, I have to look at this as how good is this writer? How well are they reaching an audience? Does this writer have a huge potential audience, you know? Do they have skills beyond their understanding that are just God-given abilities that you don't learn in a writing class, you know? And so I make a lot of judgment calls on this kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, I know that you've written several books on writing. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe outline a couple of those for us and pitch those?
Well, the big one is Million Dollar Outlines. Million Dollar Outlines, I really teach you the process of not just how to outline a movie or a book, but how to outline one that will become a bestseller. I teach you what the things that I'm looking for are. And my wife, when I wrote the book, she asked me how much it was worth. And I says, I don't know. The people I've taught this to have ended up, you know, becoming number one international bestsellers. I think that if you apply the principles, it's worth a good $100,000, you know? And she's like, $100,000, how much are you going to charge? And I was thinking, well, maybe $9.99. I think it's definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Million dollar book signings. I teach you how to launch your career using book signings as a tool. But it also gets into your web page and how you throw a book signing and where you do the book signings and when, time of year, things like that. With my book, Drawing on the Power of Resonance in Writing, I talk about resonance, the secret language that each genre uses, and how you can leverage that in writing to an audience. I've got another book that I'm almost finished with called Casting Your Novel, in which I help you create characters. I show you how to create characters, but I go into the heroes, the villains, the sidekicks, the love interests, the guide characters, the contagonist, as it's called, and other things. And so the idea that you aren't casting a single character for a book, you're casting different types of characters that conflict with one another and that bump up against each other like billiard balls, you know? And so I'm working on that. And then I'm working on one on science fiction, fantasy, world building, creating magic systems and societies and things like that for fantasy and science fiction. And so well, those are the books I've got in the process right now. And I think probably the next book that I'll work on will maybe be Writing and Chatting Prose, will probably be the next one down the line. Mm-hmm. That's probably a couple of years from now.
Well, I haven't exactly kept a scorecard, but I think you're about up to 7 works in progress.
Yeah. I'm closer to 15, but I didn't tell you about my top secret ones. So
yeah.
Well, I just want to tell our listeners, you know, if you have an opportunity to go to Dave's courses, like I've been, and really valuable, highly valuable, especially for learning how to tell a story effectively, so that you're winning your audiences over.
Yeah, great courses.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us today. How's the best way for people to contact you?
Just go to my site, mystorydoctor.com. There's a place that you can email me. I teach writing courses, and I also sometimes edit books, or if you've got questions, I do Q&A sessions with people. A lot of people will try to figure out how to break into publishing, or they'll have a problem with a novel, and so they'll call and have me brainstorm with them for an hour, so you can hire services like that. Mm-hmm. Like I say, that's the kind of thing I'm trying to get away from, so I probably shouldn't mention that. But I'm so busy with it all the time. I love helping others. I'm My wife has always said, you know, have you, you know, you should make a decision. Are you going to be a writer or a teacher? And I said, yes.
Yes.
I am. I'm a writer and a teacher. So I enjoy doing both of them.
Well, we have certainly been the beneficiary of both of those sides of your career, both as a writer, you've got some amazing books out there, and as a teacher. So thank you. Thank you for your contribution to the world.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for joining us.
And that's great to see you. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you too.
Okay. Have a great night.
Visit our website at CalliopeWritingCoach.com. There you can find detailed show notes for each of our podcast episodes. And while you're there, be sure to check out the Submission Possible series, our 12-part online writing course where Angie gives you everything you need to have a successful writing career.